Hello and welcome to the Counting the Earth podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Sue Nelson.
And I'm Alice Hope. Throughout this podcast, we explore the environment and the natural world, but always through the lens of one number.
And today's number is 2080, as in the year 2080, because in this podcast, we will be time travelling 55 years into the future to explore what foods we might be growing in the UK under a changed climate. In a moment, we'll hear what UKCEH predicts will be the shape of farming in the late 21st century and identify which crops are likely winners or losers.
And I'll be talking to the co-founder of Hodmadod, a food company that's already working with British farmers to help them future-proof their business in the face of an increasingly chaotic climate.
But before we fire up the DeLorean, now that's not a reference that's too old for you, is it, Alice?
No, Back to the Future is actually one of my favourite films, so we should definitely fire up the DeLorean.
Excellent. Well, in that case, let's do a quick recap of what British farming looks like now.
The UK produces just over half of the food that we eat, from meat and dairy to edible plants, so cereals, vegetables such as potatoes and onions, fruit such as apples, and my favourite, strawberries. But three of these dominate: wheat, barley, and oilseed rape.
We're already seeing how relying on only a few crops has a high risk as climate change makes its mark. Weather extremes, be it a drought or a deluge, have become a more regular problem for our farmers in recent years, disrupting both planting and harvesting. And this is only going to increase in the future.
So a number of projects are underway trying to understand how we might adapt to such climatic challenges across the next few decades, including the recently published research by UKCEH on what food crops will and won't be viable in the UK in half a century's time. Leading that research was spatial ecologist Dr. John Redhead, and I started by asking him to set out the scope of that project.
We were working on a big modelling project called OpenClim, which was a big team of researchers from several UK research institutes and universities that all came together to look at using the latest climate projections and the latest set of models to produce a coherent set of climate risk assessments for the UK.
And when you say climate assessments, for what particular crops were you looking at?
Well, that wider project was looking at a whole range of different climate impacts, so right across all the sectors of society and the environment. So it involved things like heat stress and floods and impacts on urban development. But the bit that UKCEH were focusing on was the impacts on agriculture. So that included looking at what might happen to the yields of crops we currently grow and that the UK agricultural system is currently heavily dependent on. But it also included a sort of wider look at which crops we might be growing in the future by the time we get out to 2080. How might our agricultural systems have changed and how might we start adapting new crops which might cope better with the climates we might be experiencing in 50 years' time?
What is the forecast then? What traditional UK crops are likely to lose out or change?
Well, it depends a bit on which climate warming scenario you pick. So we explored two scenarios. So we explored a 2-degree scenario where the global average temperature increases by 2 degrees above the pre-industrial average. And we explored a 4-degree scenario, which is where it increases by 4 degrees. And both of those sort of projecting out to 2080 give you slightly different answers. What we tend to see under both of those scenarios is a big polarization in the UK, where the south and east gets hotter and drier, particularly in the summers. And that leads to really challenging conditions for growing a lot of the crops we currently grow. So things like wheat, oats, barley, so you start to see decreased suitability in the south and east. If you move up into Scotland and into the west of the UK, actually you start seeing many of those crops showing increases in suitability under climate change, as those areas that are currently a bit cold and wet get warmer and drier and the crops benefit from that interaction. So you get this big polarization in terms of which bits of the UK do well under climate change and which do badly for those crops. Now that sounds like, well, why don't we just shift those crops further north then and move those crops into the bits of the country where they do well? And of course, the challenge with that is our whole agricultural system and all our food supply chains are currently set up to produce the majority of our crops in the south and east. So if you're going to try and shift things around, there are big barriers to overcome to use that as a method of adapting to climate change.
I feel like that's an understatement because you're right. Everywhere you go in large parts of England, you see wheat fields and barley and oats. And so to suddenly realise that with this temperature rise, it's more than a sort of adaptation. It's a complete change of lifestyle, of approach, of business, of everything really. And also, I assume the things we eat and rely on.
Yeah. So if you're going to shift things around, it's a complete reconfiguration of the agricultural system and the food supply chain. And that's why one of the other things we were really keen to look at was not just what's going to happen to current crops and how might you move them around, but also a really wide look at all of these other crops you might grow instead. So you might keep our agriculture in the same places, but shift the kind of crops we grow or diversify the range of crops we grow. So we used a model that looked for about 160 different crops, and those included these crops that we currently grow in the UK. They included a bunch of crops which we grow in the UK, but only in very small amounts, things like sunflowers and flax and hemp. And they also included a whole range of crops which we don't grow in the UK at all, at least commercially, but which are grown on the near continent, so in France and Spain. Things like durum wheat, citrus fruits, those sorts of things.
So effectively, you're looking at what could potentially take the place of wheat and barley and oats in the future.
That's right, yes. And I think one of those key points to make about these sorts of exploratory exercises, horizon scans, as we call them, is that they start to help identify what might be those plausible pathways. So asking a farmer to make a dramatic switch from growing their current crop rotation of wheat, barley and oilseed rape to suddenly growing orange trees is going to be a massive change and a massive risk in terms of ensuring that climate is actually going to be suitable for that. Whereas merely substituting wheat for durum wheat in 1 year of the rotation, or substituting their field beans for lentils or chickpeas, which are both crops that actually become much more suitable under climate change across most of the UK, is much less of a risk for the farmer. And actually, we know from other bits of research that diversifying your portfolio of crops, so just having more crops in your rotation, is a really good way of, sort of hedging your bets against climate change, because it reduces the likelihood of any one crop encountering a climatic extreme to which it's particularly vulnerable in any given year.
I think that's a really good point about the shift and change in learning and in skills, because there'll also be a shift and change culturally as well. There are some crops that we hold quite preciously in the UK as being British crops. And looking at your research, I noticed that under the 4-degree scenario, the British strawberry might be under threat, and strawberries are my favourite. So I found that absolutely horrifying. And thinking about events like Wimbledon, that's such a big part of that event. And it could actually have quite a big impact on the cultural opinion on food, couldn't it?
Yeah, and food is an important part of culture worldwide. Strawberries are an interesting example because they're one of the very few crops in the modelling that do badly across the entirety of the UK. They don't show this polarisation of north-south. They actually do poorly everywhere. Strawberries as well, we've already seen a big change in the way we eat strawberries. You go back 20 years, we grew most of those under open field conditions in the UK. Nowadays, we actually import strawberries from greenhouses in the south of Spain. And of course, the south of Spain is experiencing even more extreme climate change than we are. So their ability to produce strawberries and the availability of water to produce strawberries under glass is going to be impacted by climate change as well. And there are other really interesting aspects to that sort of cultural element. The idea of English wine was sort of very much a fringe theory if you go back a few decades. Nowadays, the English wine sector is really growing. And a lot of that is directly as a result of climate change, making the conditions suitable for growing a wider variety of wine grapes. And that's what we see in our model. Wine grapes are one of the things that does really well, even when you get out to 2080 and a 4-degree warming scenario.
So there are obviously some winners and losers here in terms of crops. If you enjoy a glass of wine like me, then things are looking up in terms of English products, but not so much on others. And in terms of the sort of winners with a 4-degree rise, some of those crops seem to be the ones that we're being encouraged to eat more of, like pulses and cereals.
Yes, a lot of those crops which supply lots of protein and make a viable alternative when you're trying to reduce the amount of animal protein we have in our diets do quite well under climate change. So that includes things like chickpeas and lentils. And we've actually seen the first commercial crop of chickpeas be produced in the last couple of years. Haricot beans, so we had our headlines around the first British-grown baked beans, which came out a couple of years ago. Also, things like British-grown soya are becoming a viable option under climate change, and farmers are already starting to experiment with some of those. So lots of those protein crops that do particularly well, even under the higher level warming scenarios.
You mentioned about the hotter, drier summers that we might be expecting under these climate projections, particularly in the southeast. But certainly over the last couple of years, we've had a real big problem with excess rainfall. It feels like it's just rained for the past 2 years. And I know that's had a big impact on the agricultural sector. I read that the wheat harvests in particular are doing really badly. Are we expecting to see more of that kind of extreme weather as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So not only are we expecting to see sort of warmer, wetter winters on average under climate change, we're likely to see an increased frequency and extremity of these sort of extreme rainfall events. That also applies to other extreme climatic events as well. We're going to see more droughts, more heat waves, especially under the higher levels of warming. That's an important point with this kind of modelling. What we're doing is this sort of horizon scan. So this is a first pass at looking which crops might be viable in the future. We know there are going to be other barriers to overcome to actually integrating these into our crop rotations. And one of those barriers is how vulnerable these new crops are going to be to those climatic extremes. So can we bring them into a rotation, or are they really at an unfeasible level of risk for a farmer if we get a rainfall event, which means they can't sow them at exactly the right time or harvest them at exactly the right time? And those sort of extreme events are really what's been driving those poor yield years we've been seeing for some of our current crops. It's not a direct physical impact on the plant in the way it can grow. It's the weather, meaning the farmer can't get out onto the field and manage them at the right time and in the right way.
And it's obviously quite a complicated picture because, as you alluded to earlier, there are reasons why you can't just simply transfer the growing of one specific crop from one part of the UK to another. Not just infrastructure, though, is it?
Yes, of course. So a good example is when you run these sorts of models, they tend to show you that the West Country is the ideal place to grow a very wide variety of crops. It's both nice and warm, and it gets a lot of rain coming off the Atlantic, so it's nice and wet as well. But if we look at where crops are currently grown in the UK, they're not down in the West Country, because the soils down there, and particularly the topography down there, make it really difficult to have large, productive arable fields in that landscape. And that's why our arable land is mostly actually in the east of the country, where it's much drier. But we have nice flat areas of land with nice fertile soils that make it ideally suited to growing crops.
Another issue that we have to deal with under climate change is this sort of northward shift of ranges. As the temperatures increase, that makes places like Scotland more viable for certain crops. But they have a similar issue there, don't they?
They do, although the east coast of Scotland does have its specialty crops that it's well known for. Scottish raspberries grow there very well, and they're actually likely to be reasonably robust under climate change because it's that much further north, it's that much more insulated from that warming effect. Scottish barley, of course, we have the whole Scottish whiskey industry based on the production of Scottish barley. Again, that's likely to be more resilient to climate change because of where it is. But if you've got other crops which can now only be grown in Scotland under climate change, that's going to increase competition for what Scotland currently produces in its relatively limited arable area on that east coast.
And could I ask, what is the prospect and the likelihood of a 4-degree change by 2080?
If we continue on our current trend of warming, we're on track for about a 3-degree warming scenario. So we're about halfway between our 2-degree scenario and our 4-degree scenario. So we're going to be somewhere in between those two sets of results that we modelled in all likelihood.
Which I find really scary, because 10, 20 years ago, a 2 to 4 degree rise would have just been considered, oh no, that's the disaster scenario.
This is completely plausible now. Of course, if we radically change what we're doing and we do actually manage to stick to the Paris targets and limit things to a 1.5 degree level of warming, then we won't get to the sort of levels of extremes that we've started to see in our modelling. And that needs to take place right now, and it needs to have an impact right across all those sectors which influence our ability to impact the climate.
Our thanks go to Dr. John Redhead there for his fascinating insight into the future of food in the UK. Now, long-time listeners of the podcast might recognise John's voice as he took part in our very first episode on hedgerows. And if you haven't listened to that podcast yet, we would highly recommend it.
Of course we would.
Not least for some of the surprising hedgerow inhabitants one of our guests found on his farm.
Now, I can't help but mention that you did sound a bit upset there by those poor predictions for strawberries.
I was absolutely heartbroken. What is a British summer without a British strawberry? Strawberries and cream, strawberries with scones. It's a must have of the summer for me.
Well, maybe I'm a bit better because I like raspberries slightly more than strawberries, but at least we'll be able to toast the strawberries' demise, perhaps with a crisp, cool glass of English wine. Although, of course, it's worth mentioning here that the models John and his team created were looking at what would be possible to grow in open fields in the UK in 2080. In reality, there are many ways we already artificially change the climate that our crops experience, from the basics, such as planting crops out as seedlings, not seeds, or irrigation, to growing undercover, like using polytunnels or in greenhouses.
What this research demonstrates, though, is the size of the climatic hurdles these crops will face. We already grow some of the British strawberry crop undercover, and it's fair to assume that such approaches will become more widespread as the climate becomes less and less suited for open field growth. And as John said, just because they're in a greenhouse doesn't mean they're climate exempt. You still need a lot of water to produce strawberries under glass, and southern Spain is already experiencing how challenging that can be.
Yes, and it wasn't all doom and gloom, as we heard. I mentioned those raspberries, you know, in Scotland, they'll be robust, as will barley for the whiskey industry, something else I'm rather happy about. But something I hadn't thought of is how, you know, despite this robustness, those crops could still be threatened by competition from other crops which had been grown further south but are now suitable for growing in the new Scottish climate in 55 years' time. So it really is about the whole system rather than just the viability of the crops themselves.
And it's not just about the crops we already grow. As John said, a changing climate could make it possible to grow new crops too. He mentioned a couple of trial harvests of chickpeas and of haricot beans for baked beans that have already happened in the UK. Suffolk-based food company Hodmadod supported the farmers growing these crops. Their mission is to help farmers to start adapting to our climate future now. I caught up with co-founder Josiah Meldrum at a farming conference to find out how that was going. We're here in the courtyard of the Story Museum in Oxford, which is one of the venues for the Oxford Real Farming Conference. There's posters advertising the conference around, delegates are milling around and huddling together in the cold, talking about what they've learned. Thankfully, it's a nice dry day today, but on farms across the UK, there's been some difficulties with the weather that we've been having over the past couple of years, the wet weather recently and the dry weather a few years ago. Farmers are really grappling with climate change every day already, aren't they?
That's right. I mean, certainly the farmer group that we work with through Hodmadod have been addressing multiple issues over across multiple years. And I think the thing that's really interesting and the thing that's really makes this difficult is the uncertainty that comes with that. We historically, you know, the medieval saints days, the holy days when crops were planted or harvested and you mark the calendar, the agricultural year with those, that certainty has gone. And those planting windows have been extended. And even when those planting windows are met, we're losing crops due to flooding, due to high rainfall events, or due to very dry springs. And some of the late planted spring crops that we work with are being lost because there's not enough water. To make matters worse, we're sometimes getting mid-summer, very, very extreme rainfall events that are flattening crops and making them incredibly difficult to harvest. So there's a whole extra layer of complexity and risk that farmers are dealing with.
You mentioned your company, Hodmadod, there. Before we go any further, I've never heard the word Hodmadod before. Could you just talk a little bit about what that word means?
Yeah, Hodmadod is a dialect word from East Anglia, and depending on whether you're in Norfolk or Suffolk, it means either a hedgehog or a snail, or possibly a small curled up thing, like a seed. And when we founded our business, which was aiming to revive crops that are being lost to the table, that we're not eating anymore, we wanted to pick a word and reflect the cultural context within which those crops are disappearing. And the dialect words that were once really commonly used in East Anglia are all disappearing as well, like the crops. And I think that agroecological principle, that idea that we link culture to food, is so important.
Yeah, I think it's a lovely word. I think it's a great choice. What is it that Hodmadod does?
That's a good question. Hodmadod emerged from a community project in Norwich in 2008-09, which asked a question: can a city the size of Norwich, about 140,000 to 160,000 people, could it feed itself? And if it were to feed itself, how might that change diet and land use? Because the question really is, how do we produce the food that we need to eat that nourishes us in a way that doesn't compromise the world around us, that doesn't impact on the environment, and is resilient to the kind of shocks that we're facing through climate change? The last bit that we looked at was leguminous crops, beans and peas and pulses, which we realised were this incredibly important element in the rotation, in that they supply nitrogen to other plant species, they build soil quality, they build soil organic matter, they develop porosity in the soil, which will hold water, and nutritionally they're a fantastic food for us to eat. And we need to move away from the intensively produced meat we're eating, which is very grain dependent and soya dependent, which has impacts in other parts of the world, to a system that uses livestock in a rotational way to cycle nutrients and provides us with nutrient-dense food, but is perhaps a smaller part of our diet. And in that case, that's where the pulses, those beans and peas and chickpeas and lentils, become a more important part of what we're eating and become a critical part of a kind of a resilient food system broadly.
You mentioned these beans, peas, pulses, these leguminous crops. They add nitrogen to the soil. So how does that work?
Yeah, it's amazing. So there are bacteria in the soil that have the capacity to take nitrogen from the atmosphere and turn it into ammonium nitrate, which feeds plants. Plants cannot do that on their own, but they can feed the bacteria sugar, attract them to their roots, and then make use of the nitrogen that those bacteria are fixing from the atmosphere. And it's fantastic. And peas and fava beans or field beans are completely self-sufficient in nitrogen as a consequence of that. They don't need any ammonium nitrate added to the plant, and obviously those synthetic fertilisers are responsible, depending on which paper you read, 2.5-3% of global man-made climate emissions. It's extraordinary, and pulses don't need any of that.
So there's not only sort of the health benefits of eating more pulses, which we know is good for us, it's also better for the planet too, because it reduces our need for these fossil fuel-based fertilisers, is that right?
That is absolutely the case. And there is a small amount of nitrogen that is left in the soil that benefits the following crop, the plant that comes after the legume in the soil. There are multiple benefits to growing those crops in the field, and we really need to get more of them into our rotations.
Thinking about the health benefits then of these beans and pulses, why is it that you want to see an increase in consumption of these beans and pulses in the UK?
I think there are multiple reasons. I think people often think about beans and peas from a protein perspective, and obviously they are a really good source of protein, but they also contain a fantastic quantity of fibre, both in terms of carbohydrates but also resistant starches, which are digested lower down in our gut and are really good for our physical and mental health. In fact, beans make you happy, and they have trace elements, they have iron, they're a very complete food, and we don't eat enough of them, and instead we feed them to animals. It's a really inefficient way of making use of the land that we're using. It's a land use opportunity cost that comes with that. Energetically, it's a really inefficient way of turning those pulse crops into food that we eat when we could just be eating the pulse crops straight from the field.
And over the past few years, there has been an increase in plant-based diets in the UK. Are we not really seeing an increase in consumption of these beans and pulses alongside that?
They are having a moment, and there is an increase in interest in them, but we're nowhere near where we could be and where perhaps other cultures in other parts of the world are, where pulses form a really key part of the diet. In the UK, we industrialised early, we went through an agricultural revolution early, which made meat and dairy products much more widely available and much more affordable, which is great, but it also meant that we moved away from some of those traditional food crops that we were growing here. And that didn't really happen in India, it didn't happen in Mexico, it didn't happen in North Africa, and those places still have a diet that is really puts pulses in the centre and sees meat as this high-value, really interesting thing that we might have in addition to that.
How is Hodmadod working with farmers to help them grow these crops?
The way we work with farmers is to often identify what they're already doing and find alternative routes to market for it. So, for example, they might be growing pulse crops that are fed to animals. Can we change the variety, look at the species that they've chosen, look at the way that they're harvesting and producing that crop, and then find a higher value route to market to customers in shops or through our website or wherever? So that's the first question. And then after that, we begin to look at how they might change their wider system. How do we put pulses in the middle of the rotation, the arable rotation, which might include cereals, pulses, oilseed rape? Legumes tend to be a break crop, a disease break, you know, a rest from growing cereals. How do we put them in the middle and start to think about the benefits of what follows? And the only way you do that is make them more valuable to the farmer, both agroecologically but also economically. So that's what we're helping them to do, and helping them to rethink how they're growing their crops more broadly by finding new markets for them that incentivize the production of those pulse crops.
So it's not just about what's grown, but actually thinking about the whole food system and how we can get these crops into the UK market more easily.
Yeah, so pulses are a fantastic lever for change. They in themselves are not necessarily the whole answer, but they are a way in which we can begin to help people rethink about their diets by putting pulses at the centre of the plate rather than just at the edge. And they're a way that we can help farmers begin to rethink about their crop rotations by putting pulse crops in the middle of the rotation rather than as the slightly annoying, not very high value break crop in their cereal production.
Which crops are you focusing on helping farmers to grow in the UK?
I think our starting point is really with crops that farmers are familiar with and that they know how to grow, and maybe they have a low value market for them, and we can make some changes there through varietal selection or to a certain extent species selection. So that would be peas, which are harvested dry rather than green, and there are split peas and whole peas, and there are varieties that are much underrated like Carlin peas, which are a traditional dark skinned variety. And then there are the beans that we grow in the UK are a dried form of broad beans. They're called field beans or fava beans. Those two species grow brilliant here, and they have done for millennia, and we've always grown them, and our climate is really well suited to them. But there are a whole host of other species of leguminous plants that perhaps historically we haven't grown here, but that may become more easy to grow as climate changes. So we are doing a lot of trial work with farmers looking at crops like fasciolus beans. So that's when you think about haricot beans or kidney beans or cannellini beans. Those are all a species called fasciolus. We're looking at lentils. Lentils are, we tend to think of them as a Mediterranean crop. The historic record suggests that lentils were grown in the UK quite widely at one point, and we're relearning how to grow those crops in the UK. And then there's things like chickpeas. They've become very much a mainstay in hummus and in all sorts of very familiar foods, but we don't grow them here. And there's no reason, I think, given where else they're grown in Northern Europe, why we couldn't be working out how to grow chickpeas in the UK as well.
Your last point around the changing climate and the fact that some of these crops may become viable in the UK over the next decades ties in really nicely to our headline number for this episode, which is 2080, as in 2080, the year 2080, looking at what kind of crops we might be growing over the next 55 years. How important is it that we lay the foundations for that now? Because there's a lot of change in terms of culture, training, knowledge that's going to be needed in order to grow those crops, aren't there?
That is absolutely right. And really, that's why Hobbendob was founded in the first place. It was, how do we build a resilient food system that's fit for a changing climate in the future? I think possibly the popular misconception is often, and we come across this when we do talks, is that we're in this rather turbulent transfer between one steady state in the climate to a new state in the climate. Maybe it's going to be warmer and lovely and we'll just be growing lots of grapes. I think the reality is that we're moving into a chaotic system, and we're seeing that, as we talked about earlier on, in the variability in the weather across the year, the intensity of rainfall events, the difficulty with dry periods. So what we need is a toolkit. We need a diversity of crops, a set of options that farmers can use. And within resilient systems, you need a degree of redundancy. You need to accept that there are things that might not necessarily work every year. And so some years might be perfect for chickpeas, some years might not be. And we need to make sure we're balancing farm production planning in order to ensure that when we can take advantage of those opportunities, we do, but that we also have other crops that we can grow at the same time. So my feeling is that the 2080 scenario, we see very radically different crop production in the UK, and I'm not entirely sure what that will look like. We're learning all the time, and it's really important that we begin trialing, we begin screening and understanding what genotypes are suitable And that's happening with chickpeas in particular. A lot of work is going on understanding chickpea genetics and understanding what traits might enable us to grow them more readily in the UK. Those will be grown in complex systems. They might be grown in agroforestry systems between rows of woody species that help manage microclimate and bring all sorts of extra benefits, water retention, enabling plants to access nutrients that aren't otherwise readily available. So I think we'll see a much more complex farming system. And what we have to ensure is that we understand how to develop that system without making the farmer's life unbelievably complicated, both in terms of what's happening in the field, but also post-harvest, how we handle those crops, how we get them to customers. And there's a big bit of work there about encouraging customers, encouraging eaters to experiment with and explore these new crops that maybe they're not very familiar with and maybe aren't currently a key part of their diet.
My thanks go to Josiah Meldrum of Hodmadod for sparing me the time during a very busy conference to talk over his vision of the future of farming. I should add here that not only were there farmers coming and going from the conference sessions at the Story Museum, but also, as you could hear, a number of children were there enjoying the delights of the museum's everyday job to explore the power of storytelling.
He sounded incredibly enthusiastic and enervated by this whole discussion.
Definitely. He was incredibly passionate, and you can see why, really. There's so many really interesting and amazing things that we're finding out more and more about the crops that we could grow. I mean, I didn't realise that you can actually use these crops as a sort of natural fertiliser where they add nitrogen into the soil, not only for themselves, but there's also some left over for future crops as well.
I liked his quotes as well, beans make you happy, because there are other words you associate with beans as well, but because they're digested lower down in our gut and are good for our mental health. But I'm more of a fan of lentils, to be honest. I really like green lentils in particular. And so I was really happy to hear that we could be growing lentils in the UK in the not too distant future.
Yes, I thought that was really interesting as well. You definitely think of them as a crop that's grown very, very far away. But Josiah did highlight the level of risk with these crops. What works one year may not work another year, and rain at the wrong time flattens lentils and completely causes the crop to fail.
The other point he made, which did slightly take me aback, was when he said that synthetic fertilisers are responsible for 2.5 to 3% of man-made climate emissions. I was just, good grief. Did you feel the same, or were you aware of that figure, Alice?
I was aware of that figure, but I don't think everyone is. And it's a part of the farming system that has come to light a lot around water quality and sort of where it's running off into the wider environment. It's not thought about in terms of carbon emissions, but that brings me on to something that John said, which is that we're already on track for somewhere between the 2 and 4 degree warming scenarios he was talking about. And not that long ago, that would have been unthinkable. So if we can reduce the use of these fertilizers, that would also contribute to reducing the degree warming scenario as well.
Now, I don't want to sound as if I'm obsessed with lentils, but the other thing that, again, I was like, oh, I didn't know that, was that lentils used to be grown in the UK. And apparently they've been trying to grow lentils this year, but not had so much luck. So I do wonder, though, whether the climate is a bit sort of unpredictable at the moment, particularly with the constant rain, whether that will work or not. But I hope it does.
Yes, I think that's a really good point to make, that we think of the climate as being fairly stable and we're not going from one stable place to another. As Josiah said, we're entering a period of uncertainty where there's going to be more extremes and there is a much higher level of risk. And that's why this diversity is so important, and why actually John looking at 160 different crops, a real range of crops in this study, is so important.
Yes, and we come back again and again, I think, to this point, is that need for research and data in all sorts of areas to ensure that we're sort of prepared for what's going to happen, particularly in agriculture and farming, that they know the trends with weather and rainfall and sunshine and crops and soils and what will work and what doesn't. Because if we don't do this and we don't plan, we could be in trouble. But if we do use the data and collect the data and do plan, we will be prepared. And yes, there will be changes. And yes, it might mean that different crops and different industries might have to shift geographically. But the bigger picture is that the UK will still be okay.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think you raised a really important point about the farming industry having to change, but it's also consumers that are going to have to change and think about what we're eating. And I think food is such a big part of culture. I'm going to mention it again. You've got British strawberries at Wimbledon. You've got the cider industry. You've got the barley industry and Scottish whiskey. And these things are tied to a sense of cultural identity. So it's not just a turbulent time for the food industry, but also for food and its role within culture.
That's a very good point. And I've never heard that word hodmadod, even though I have a husband who is from Norfolk. I'll have to ask him if he's heard of that word. But that's what Josiah was doing as well, is linking this local dialect word and food and culture. So yes, you're exactly right.
So a period of change for consumers and a period of change for the climate. I found that was just a really fascinating insight into the future of crops in the UK.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to the Counting the Earth podcast, and we hope you'll join us again next time for another look at nature through numbers.